Pocket Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today our guest joins us from two companies. He is the non-executive chairman at Emerson PLC and Trident Royalties, and it's James Kelly. So, James, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you, James. We've not had spoken to you before. We have spoken to Adam at Trident, and we've also spoken to Graham at Emerson on the podcast and interviewed them both as well. But yeah, it's nice to have you on as well. And Kenny, of course, is joining us. Are you doing okay, Kenny?
Yep, doing well up in Scotland. James, how you doing?
Yeah, no, I'm great. Nice to meet you too, Kenny.
Yep. And where are you from? Or where are you based now, James?
So, I'm born and raised in London, but actually I live down in the West Country now, just outside Exeter.
All right, lovely, lovely part of the world. Yeah, that's, yeah, my son's, he's in Plymouth at the moment with the Navy, so yeah, it's not far away, is it?
Yeah, no, that's not far at all. It's about 40 minutes from here.
Yeah, good spot there. Yeah, it's nice. Cool. Mm. All right. No, it's good. Great to have you on, James. And what we like to do in these podcasts is, as well as talk about, you know, we're going to talk about Trident and we're going to talk about Emerson, we like to hear people's backstory, because we're great believers that you can have the best projects in the world, but if you don't have the right people behind these projects, they'll simply fail. So our ethos is, you know, people invest in people. So what we're going to do probably for the first 10, 15, or maybe even 20 minutes, it depends how good your story is, James, is for you to go back as far as you want, you know, where you were brought up, you know, early education, you know, maybe went to university, what, you know, what your first career break was, and then basically your journey to Emerson and Trident. And again, it's up to you how much detail you want to go into. It's really, the show is yours for the next sort of 10 minutes. So
great.
Over to you.
Great. Well, thank you. Well, I won't go all the way back into the depths of time, but as I said, you know, I'm born and raised in the UK in the southeast. You know, a pretty normal, you know, relatively fortunate upbringing. Went to university in London, studied geography or colouring, probably as it's better known, really. And then after university, I mean, I suppose, you know, if you think about things that sort of have a big influence on you, rather than leaping straight into the world of work, I decided to travel through Africa. So it's actually part of a group that drove London to Cape Town. This is back 99, so, you know, a long time ago now. You know, we sort of drove all the way through West Africa, camped everywhere, and it's quite a defining period, really. So we went with a bunch of people who I didn't know, and spending that much time in close proximity with people means you get to know yourself and other individuals pretty well. Mm. But more importantly, sort of opened my eyes to the broader world that's out there, and, you know, different countries and experiences, and, you know, how fortunate we are in living in the UK. And I say, went, you know, all the way through West Africa, so actually Morocco, Mauritania, all the way down through to Central Africa, where we sort of got to the border with CAR, and this was around the time of the height of the Congo Civil War. So we had to fly over Congo, and then all the way down the east, and it was phenomenal. Sort of spent a year doing that, did some work in South Africa on a game farm, but, you know, came back and, you know, scratched my head around, you know, what did I want to do? You know, I'd always been relatively good with numbers, so ended up doing a CA, accountancy training, with a bent to natural resources. So I did it at one of the big four firms, and naturally just fell into the resources sector within that organization. Indeed, my first client actually was the Libyan National Oil Company. So I spent the first month of my training in a hotel in Tripoli, which was pretty interesting. Through the course of that, realized that I really enjoyed that side of things, and ended up working on the IPO of Vedanta, which involved me living in a hotel in Mumbai and traveling around India for the best part of 6 months, which was, that's really sort of really ignited my love of mining, to be honest. Just understanding the breadth of commodities, the breadth of operations, and sort of every day is a school day, really, in, when you're looking at different mining projects. And that just sort of resonates with my sort of, I guess, inquisitive nature on things.
Mm. Did you enjoy Africa, James?
Loved it. And I still do. It's one of those places where I think it sort of gets into your blood a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's such a big continent with a vast array of, you know, countries cultures. And, you know, so, you know, with reference to Emerson and Morocco, that's a world away from another project I worked with in the Republic of Congo, the Zanagra iron ore project. I mean, the two couldn't be more different, but they're equally fascinating. So I've done a lot of work in my career in Africa, as well as in South America and other places. But, you know, it's one of those things that sort of, ignited a bit of a passion, really. Yeah, I finished my accounting training, didn't really want to stay as an accountant, you know, great career, but not really for me. And I went to work at Vedanta. They just newly listed. I obviously knew the company inside out. So I went there as the sort of CFO's offsider, stayed there for a while, you know, then moved into, I was an equity research analyst at JP Morgan, covering sort of global mining companies and European listed stocks, which was interesting. And you put those sort of two together and it gives you a pretty good grounding on understanding, you know, what to look for in mining companies and what drives them. What I really wanted to do was get a little bit more into the heartbeat of mining companies, you know, and really sort of building them out and sort of growing them. And an opportunity came up to join Xstrata. And this was back at the time we were doing the transaction to buy Falcon Bridge. So back in 2006, I think it was, five, six. So, you know, real sort of the heyday of the last super cycle. You know, I was late 20s, you know, knew a bit, but joined the group business development team there. Which, you know, I think everyone probably knows the Xstrata story, but, you know, a phenomenal journey of doing deals. And I joined working for two, you know, very, very different, but very interesting characters running business development. And as I say, late 20s, I get to sit and work alongside, you know, Mick Davis and Trevor Reed and that small team at Xstrata, which, you know, given a huge amount of responsibility across multiple aspects, whether that's, you know, corporate finance, treasury, investor relations, and just a phenomenal place to learn and see huge experiences. You know, we all know that Xstrata ultimately ended up getting bought by Glencore. You know, I did a good, 6 or 7 years there, really sort of formed a lot of my sort of beliefs and understanding around how one looks at value, how you can create value in the mining space. And so, you know, that had been a pretty busy period of time. So then I moved on, took a little bit of break, but then together with one of the co-heads of business development, helped set up a private equity group called Greenstone Resources, whose sort of strategy was to invest in post-exploration mining projects. We raised money from a lot of blue chip sort of US endowment funds. I started deploying that capital more in the junior space. I decided to leave there after a period of time. It was a little bit too far away from the sort of proverbial coalface for me. You know, I quite enjoyed getting sort of really stuck in and you know, helping really drive forward projects, unlocking and identifying the value. So I stepped away from there. You know, most recently, we set up a shell, Trident, which, you know, we were, funnily enough, originally sort of Trident version one was a shell to acquire an operating asset or a project. But actually, it became apparent that, yeah, there were opportunities out there, but, you know, there was nothing sort of crushingly obvious for us. You know, so sitting down and sort of thinking about how we use that vehicle and started researching the royalty space, and it became more and more apparent that there was a huge opportunity there, and we can, you know, sort of come onto that a little bit later. And so we switched tack on that and created Trident Royalties now. And then, you know, most recently I've joined the board of Emerson. You know, I've been fortunate enough to move up to chair of that at what's a really interesting time for that company as well. So I guess that's a sort of a potted history, but, you know, feel free to delve into any aspects of that because there's a huge amount there.
There is a huge amount. Yeah. So going back, was it so 1999 going out to Africa there and then obviously moving through to the IPO of Vedanta and then your research research analyst at JP Morgan. Yeah, so you've had the whole kind of, yeah, from actual mining companies on the
ground. Yeah. I mean, it's quite interesting, when you sort of take a step back, and we're always guilty of not taking a step back and sort of thinking about things, but, you know, I sort of cover the global diversified, sort of the mid-tiers, you know, the junior companies, as well as sort of that primary investing from a private equity perspective, and obviously the banking side of things too. Mm. So, you know, I'm quite fortunate in that, you know, I can sort of look at things from multiple ways and with multiple hats on.
And what do you think then about Africa as a place for exploration? I mean, you mentioned there the last sort of super cycle. So you've obviously been through one, which I'd like to discuss as well at some point. But in terms of Africa as a continent, some people say it's the most underexplored place in the world. And some of the jurisdictions are nicer than others, you know, in terms of how the governments are. But yeah, what do you think about that as a place to do business and explore for stuff?
Wow, we could spend hours talking about that, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, that's the beauty of Africa is that, you know, it's tens of countries and everyone is different politically, fiscally, geologically, culturally. So sort of where do you want to start? I mean, you know, everyone will, I mean, the mineral endowment of somewhere like the DRC is just, you know, it's well known, it's phenomenal, but it can be a very difficult place to operate. You know, and that could be because of infrastructure or it can be because of the geopolitical risks that are there. But, you know, it is eminently doable to build a project there and unlock the value of those resources. I mean, just to take a good example in the market right now, Alphamin has done a phenomenal job. So, I mean, it is, you know, in my opinion, the best tin resource on the planet. So, you know, it should be developed, but it's in an inaccessible part of the DRC. They've done a great job of building that mine out. And now with, you know, tin rising rapidly, it's, you know, people are starting to see that, but the drill results just keep on coming on that project. So, but it's been a slow burn. You know, if that asset had been, if it'd been in Morocco, even within Africa, it would have been developed probably ahead of that and the value would have been seen sooner. But that is that's a great resource. So, huge opportunity there, but then you can go to other parts which are easier to operate and maybe they're not as geologically blessed. But I would agree with the characterization that it is somewhat overlooked and underexplored. And I think some of that goes back to, you know, it is a risky place to do business. And so historically, money has not flowed there or has flowed and then flowed away. And, you know, I think sometimes investors can lump the whole of Africa together as one entity when that's not fair. So, you know, you look at Tanzania has had its problems with, you know, the whole Barrick and Acacia situation. And I think, you know, mining is long-term capital. And so when you get to a position where there are changes in the fiscal regime or relationships with the government, that can scare away that capital. And there's a sort of a halo effect around that that means that, you know, Tanzania has been off sort of off the agenda for a long time, but that sort of seeps out to the rest of Africa. And so particularly in the darker times in the industry, you know, people look for a reason not to invest and that can often, you know, cause some problems for Africa. But, you know, I really enjoy working there. I enjoy working in the different jurisdictions. You know, and with my Emerson hat on, I mean, it is such a great place to operate for multiple reasons. I mean, it's got a very sophisticated mining sector, not least because, you know, OCP, the world's largest phosphate producer, operates there. So very long on skills and understanding around how mining operates. It's very open for business, very straightforward. You know, it's frequently ranked as the sort of the number one mining jurisdiction in Africa. So, you know, there's a broad spectrum of considerations, but it is somewhere that offers opportunity, reward, but it's not without its risks. So one has to be quite considered and discerning.
Yeah, it is such a diverse place, and I get what you were saying about the bug as well, because I went to Botswana and also Zimbabwe and Zambia briefly, and even just those three countries are very, very different next to each other. Beautiful place to be. It's really, there's something about like the soul of it that's just it really does get you, and really itching to get back as soon as possible. Really,
yeah, I think we're all itching to get on planes, aren't we?
Yeah, itching to get on planes. Yeah,
definitely. Definitely. James, I wonder if I could pick your brains, because there was a phrase you mentioned quite a few times during that sort of bloody history, and that was private equity. Now, we always hear people talking about private equity, but it'd be actually nice for you to, if you could break it down for our listeners, you know, what is private equity and what kind of skills, you know, do you bring to the table? You know, what have you learned from private equity over the years?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, sometimes, look at a classic non-mining private equity, you know, is long-term money that's been raised from a group of investors, and they will give money to a private equity firm for sort of 10 years, and the private equity group and the investor will share in the profits that private equity group generates. And so, you know, they're backing a team to then go and invest that money. And often, as I say, in a non-mining sector, that will involve buying a business with and using a huge amount of leverage. That model doesn't really work in many regards for the mining space. So private equity in the mining space typically is, you know, the same model. You're taking sort of 10-year money, and then you are either buying entire assets and taking them private, or in the model of a sort of an Appian or a Greenstone, you're buying significant stakes to progress projects, bring them into production, take them up that development curve, get them re-rated, create a lot of money for shareholders, both private equity shareholders, but also, you know, the other shareholders within that organization, within that company. And then they exit, and then they will often recycle that money elsewhere. So it's, what's good about it is it aligns your investment horizon. I mean, I touched on earlier, you know, mining is a long-term capital intensive business. So, you know, there is always a slight misalignment in my view between, you know, public markets money and mining companies, because as a general comment, you know, investors in the stock market can be quite short-term vis-a-vis investing in mining projects. Mining projects, as we well know, take a resource through to production can take, you know, 10 years plus. Yeah. And how many, you know, investors in mining companies really have a multi-year investment horizon? I'd argue not that many. So the private equity model does align much better to the lengths of the cycle that we can get. You can get, you know, very long periods of down pricing. You know, what does it bring other than just that long-term capital? I mean, typically it brings quite a degree of sophistication in technical skills. Most private equity groups have, you know, have very competent in-house technical teams. It brings a lot of network contacts and sophistication to financing and sources of capital for building, you know, what are often, you know, high capital projects. You know, and sometimes it can help build out teams of people, because, you know, I think, you know, you said it up front, you know, one of the most important things that defines the success of a junior company is the quality of the management team and the project team around it. And our industry is not, and for the 20 odd years I've been involved, has never been blessed with a deep pool of talent. It's certainly on a technical and my manager front. So, you know, getting those high quality individuals can be quite hard, and private equity groups can often help through their own networks to source and attract those individuals.
Yeah. So it's a massive learning curve, obviously, going along the private equity route. But it's a great grounding, and obviously it gives you a huge amount of experience, which you've now obviously brought to the table with Emerson and Trident. I wonder if we could just sort of leave your, obviously you've brought us up to date now with your journey to these two companies. I wonder if we could just, with your Emerson hat on, for maybe listeners that have not heard of Emerson before, could you give us a sort of high-level overview of Emerson and the asset that they've got in Morocco?
Yeah, absolutely. So Emerson is a potash development company, very advanced. We're just in the throes of securing the financing to build that project. And I suppose just before I go into some of the project details, you know, it's probably worth sort of just, you know, why did I get involved with Emerson? You know, when I look at projects that I want to get involved with personally, there are sort of several things that I look at, and, you know, the quality of the project from a technical and geological perspective is really important. So tick that box, and I'll come on to that in a second. The quality of the management team, you know, and the work that's been done today, and again, very much tick that box. And then the commodity that it's in, and potash is relatively misunderstood, it's probably not quite the right characterization, but it's, I don't think it's well understood. You know, and in my view, I think it's a very interesting commodity, and not well understood why actually the outlook for that commodity is pretty positive. So when I put all of that together, you know, it's just, it forms a very attractive investment proposition, and one where, importantly, my background and skill set, I think I can really bring a huge amount of help as we step through the critical phase now, which is securing, you know, an appropriate and holistic funding package for the project. So, you know, to take it back to the project itself, you know, the primary asset is a project called Chemiset. It's based in northern Morocco. As I said, it's a potash project. And for those that don't know, potash is one of the three sort of key ingredients in fertilizers, alongside nitrogen and phosphate. The potash market has some quite oligopolistic characteristics, in that sort of seven or eight players control about 90% of the supply. So, you know, we all know oligopolies can have some quite attractive pricing stability fundamentals there as well. So the project itself, albeit it's not the highest grade resource in the world, it has a huge advantage in that it is located in a great jurisdiction, being Morocco, but more importantly, from a locational perspective, it's on Europe's doorstep. Mm. And so it has a huge freight advantage, both into the European market, the African market, and also across to the key Brazilian market. The potash industry typically has, you know, a lot of the production comes out of Russia and Canada, and has long logistics chains in order to get it to market. So that's a real advantage of the project. A feasibility study was finished about a year ago, you know, outlining some very robust economics. It'll go for nearly 20 years. It's got first quartile cash costs. It's a low capex project. So again, you know, the potash industry, oligopoly, but characterized by high barriers to entry. And that really manifests itself through high capital intensity. So you typically would be looking around, you know, $2,500 to $3,000 a ton of installed capacity. We're looking to do just under 1 million tons a year, so 750,000 tons a year for $411 million. So you know, really right down in the sort of the $500-$600 per ton of installed capacity, which is you know, closer to a brownfield type of capital intensity. And the reason for that is actually because we're very fortunate that we don't have aquifer issues. So often these potash operations are deep, have to deal with aquifers, and we don't have that issue. So that allows us a low capex startup. So we generate, based on the feasibility study, sort of an NPV of just over $1 billion, you know, IRRs sort of in the mid 30s, and sort of, you know, almost $250 million a year of EBITDA over the life of the mine. That's the average short payback period. So a really robust, attractive set of financial metrics there. So that sort of ticked the box for me in terms of, you know, is this a project that's going to be attractive to investors? Has it got a capital cost that is financeable and deliverable when I sort of look across it? And, you know, again, that was another big tick. I sort of alluded to the fact that, you know, one of the key things for me is management team, because it's great to have a feasibility study and a very deliverable project, but someone's got to build it. And so you need, and there's a real difference between someone who can advance a project through drilling and the study phase to someone who can actually build a project. And, you know, delivering them is a different set of skills. And Emerson is very fortunate that we, in Graham Clark, our CEO, we have someone who has, you know, metaphorically been there and done it, and not just, you know, sort of, you know, a little bit. I mean, he's got 25 years in the industry, ran, you know, the UK's potash mine, was involved in taking Woodsmith mine up to construction point. So, you know, he's got track record of delivering and operating mines. So he knows what that's all about. And so, you know, I spent time with Graham before coming on board and was just, you know, wholly impressed by the work that's been done, his approach, the sustainable nature of what he's doing, the team that he has started to build and the team that he has in mind to build this, both in country and sort of any required expats that are needed, which is quite minimal actually. And so I sort of put all that together, and it's just, for me, it's a really interesting opportunity.
Mm. Yeah. And, yeah. Sorry, it's just, and the potash, most people know it's used in fertilizer, you know, it's the yeah. stuff that's going to help feed the world. But there are different types, aren't they, as well? Is that right, James? And it's like SOP and polyhalite, different.
Yeah, yeah. That's entirely correct. So SOP is a sort of a value add product. Our feasibility, and polyhalite is what Woodsmith will produce. It's a sort of a new entrant to the market. What we're our feasibility study is predicated on producing MOP, which is the, you know, sort of the industry baseline standard. It's the one that most people consume.
Okay.
SOP, we can produce. It's a value add circuit, and we've done some initial work on that, and we're completing a feasibility stage or level study on that, because we think the opportunity within that segment of the potash industry is quite attractive as well. It attracts a premium price. But, you know, that's something that we may add in time, because there is obviously a capital hurdle to get over on that. So right now we're focused on the MOP side of things, but with a huge amount of optionality around adding an SOP circuit, you know, either alongside MOP or in order to replace it. But I think, you know, your point is well made. There are lots of elements there. But, you know, as with anything, you have to sort of make sure that the market's ready for additional SOP. Our view is it is, but we've got to complete our work. You know, and ultimately our focus is bringing this into production. You know, sometimes people can study projects for too long. We've got a robust project which is financeable, you know, interesting, a lot of financiers at the moment. So, you know, it's better for us to bring it into production and then alter circuits in order to add a SOP if that's appropriate in the fullness of time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And do you think then, you've given your reasons there for joining Emerson, and you know, you said, and yeah, it's in Morocco, so very north of Africa. It's a fantastic shipping route. But do you think it's been perhaps overlooked a little bit by investors or the market? I mean, I'm familiar, very familiar with Sirius Minerals, where Graham came from, being from Yorkshire. And there was an awful lot of sort of hype, well, not hype, but chatter and excitement around that project. But it doesn't seem to be so much with Emerson. But as I understand, what Emerson have is actually better than Sirius. So do you think it's been missed a little bit, maybe?
I think it's certainly been overlooked. It's one of the things that I really try, and when I sit down and think about, you know, investment opportunities, either companies I want to get involved with or when I'm making my own sort of investments, is, you know, is the market missing something here? Yeah, actually, to go back to Alphamin, that's a good example as well. But so yes, absolutely, I think the market is overlooking something. And I think that comes from probably a little bit of scar tissue from what happened with Sirius. Okay. But I think more importantly than that, I think it has actually been missed. It's not, you know, it goes back to this sort of African piece, and sometimes people steer away for it for that reason.
Yeah.
And I think also, I don't think the potash market is well understood. I don't think people sort of really understand the long-term structural strength of that market. And it's not, you know, it's not a, it's certainly not a sexy commodity. You know, it probably should be better understood and loved than it is. And, you know, just for those that don't sort of understand or know, you know, it grows, demand grows pretty consistently at sort of 2 to 3% a year. And there's a very good reason for that, which is, you know, the world is growing. population is growing, we need more food. You know, as the population expands, there's less arable land available, certainly per capita. I mean, if you look over the last 40 years, the amount of arable land per head of population has gone down a third. And in fact, last year, for the first time, you saw an absolute decline in the amount of arable land available globally, which, you know, when you contrast that with a rising population, you know, there's a 60% increase in food required by 2050. So the fundamentals of food supply are going one direction. And so why is that important for potash and fertilizers? Well, you know, you need to increase your yields, the productivity of your land. So that demand side for fertilizers broadly, but most importantly for us with the potash sort of hat on, is definitely there. Mm. But, you know, why has that not really translated into high prices? Well, partly this oligopoly side of things, and partly there was, through the last sort of super cycle, there was a bit of overinvestment. But, you know, the fundamentals are very much there, and you start to see it now. I mean, if you look at the agriculture market, you're seeing that you've got grain prices at all-time highs. You've got, across the agriculture sort of sector, you know, price is very high. And if you look at what's happened with potash, so MOP prices have risen from $250 a ton at the start of the year to $350 a ton today. You know, and that's a pretty material re-rating. You know, and actually that the current prices are in line with our feasibility study. So it is, in my opinion, it's an overlooked sector. And if I compare our market cap to the NAV of our project, or the NPV of our project, you know, it's abundantly clear to me that Emerson is overlooked and undervalued.
Mm, okay. Yeah, no, it's been good to talk to you, James, to get that insight then into your past. But I do want to finish off with something, and it's because you mentioned it earlier, and that was the last super cycle. I'm not old enough to remember super cycles in the mining and exploration space, but I certainly would like another one to come along. And it's something that we're also seeing and hearing about, you know, people talking about it. So I guess it's a double question. What was the last super cycle like? And do you see one starting, having started, or, you know, to come very soon, right now?
Okay. Wow. Okay. we've got another 40 minutes, and have we? Okay. What was the last super cycle like? Well, I suppose there's two, for me, there's two parts to that answer, because there's the sort of the personal piece, and then there's the sort of the industry piece. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was fortunate that, you know, I got to spend a lot of that, that last super cycle in the sort of the deal machine growth vehicle of the mining industry, but, you know, certainly of the non-precious mining industry, being Xstrata. And we were, I was working with some of the, you know, the biggest characters in the industry, you know, internally and externally. And from someone who was young, it was an amazing place to be. Very dynamic, you know, really sort of sets your value side of things. And as I say, for me, helped build me out as to how I look at value, and it doesn't always have to be tier one assets, etc. It just depends what you pay for them. So from that side, it was great. You know, and I think the industry is always easier when prices are high. It makes decisions that much easier. Mm-hmm. For the industry perspective, I think it was a great time in some regards, but you know, ultimately it ended, you know, with the financial crisis, you know, sort of accelerating the end of it. And it ended in a pretty dark times for the industry, with, you know, most commodities oversupplied, a lot of struggling assets, a lot of cost cutting, redundancies, asset shutting, and, you know, and that's never nice to see. But I think, you know, we should always try and learn from that. And I think the industry will, I don't think, will ever really fully learn, but I think you saw a cycle of you know, big capital projects in certainly towards the end of the last super cycle, and we were as responsible for that at Xstrata as anybody else. But I sense this time there is a lot more reticence from some of the bigger players to invest that heavily in really building out the greenfield. I think towards the end of the last super cycle, everyone sort of got a bit caught up in the China's going to grow at 8% forever and a day. And so therefore, or, you know, your demand charts just look like they're going on forever. And I think some poor decisions were made across the board and across most commodities, which has led to an oversupply in a lot of commodities for a while, including potash. So I think it was, you know, it was wild at times, definitely. And, you know, it was a period of extraordinary deals, projects, price action. And then obviously we moved into the financial crisis and everything that's sort of flown from there, whether it's Brexit or, you know, pandemic. I mean, what's been pretty crazy since then. But then moving on to your second question, which is, you know, do I think we're in one now? And how do I look at that? Would I call it a super cycle? I think we're in a very interesting time in the commodities sector. And I suppose if I was to be, in the absence of thinking of something better, I do think there is a super cycle, but it's not that sort of China led super cycle that lifts pretty much every commodity. It is one that I think there are various reasons for it. And I think the electrification of industry and vehicles and society is definitely a large element to it. I think the global fiscal response to the pandemic, stimulus, governments taking an opportunity to invest in infrastructure that tries to redistribute wealth a bit. And by that, I mean building out infrastructure projects that, you know, and taking the UK as an example, and, you know, the sort of the levelling up agenda that the Conservative government has. I think you see that playing out across the world as well. And I think that that has some profound implications for infrastructure spending. So I think when I sit down and think about, okay, well, what does that mean for specific commodities? I mean, copper is, you know, and this is a complete consensus call, but copper has just got such great fundamentals. It had great fundamentals before the sort of the EV revolution, but now it's even better. I mean, I think Goldman Sachs the other day, you know, said it, you know, called it the new oil. And when you look at the extra 5-6 million tons a year of copper that's going to be needed just to service the electrification of vehicles and other elements of society, I mean, that is a massive amount of copper annually that is required at a time when grades of copper ore bodies are still declining. So yeah, there's a real question, where do we find that? And I suspect you will see, and we are already starting to see, stronger copper prices as, you know, we're sort of wearing a little bit of the underinvestment as a hangover from the last super cycle. So the industry will find a way, because there's enough copper in the world. It's just, what is the incentive price to bring it on? So copper, you know, very interesting. I think everything else that flows around the EV sector, very, very interesting. You know, clearly we believe that, you know, look at the lithium deal for Trident recently as an example. But I think the key thing here is you have to be quite discerning. And you have to be quite careful. I think most commodities should do well, but there are certain commodities which will don't play into that thematic quite as strongly. And so, you know, you just have to really sit down and think about, okay, what are the demand supply fundamentals here? And these are typically demand driven cycles. Yes, a lack of supply can lead to a squeeze, and that squeeze can trigger some high pricing. But typically that pricing is ameliorated because additional supply comes on. And the industry, you know, can sort of address that and will address that when it's incentivized. So if you want sustained longer and stronger prices, it is a demand push rather than a supply crunch.
Okay. Well, that was good. I like that answer. Yeah, so look out for copper and EV related metals, commodities, and maybe then as well in the precious metals as well, due to the global debt and fiscal policies of governments around the world.
Precious is always, or I always find precious hard. You know, I mean, silver's got an industrial use, but gold doesn't. But you know, you can't argue with, I mean, I find it difficult to argue with 2,000 years of history. on that. But, you know, gold, I mean, we, you know, with the Trident hat on again, you know, we definitely want gold exposure. I think if you're trying to build that broad, you know, whether it's in the Trident space or if, you know, people are investing for their own portfolio, you need to have that broad portfolio. And so having the right gold exposure is important. You know, it's, again, with the Trident hat on, it's very competitive given the North American space. But, you know, gold's still very interesting. And I think, you know, you just touched on it there. We do live in extraordinary fiscal times as well. So you could definitely see a synchronized upswing in gold and precious prices together with industrials, which would be quite unusual, but it's definitely possible.
Great. Well, thank you very much, James. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
No, thank you. Thank you. No, it's been good talking to you. So, yeah, I think that's a good time to finish. Unless, Kenny, you have any final thoughts or comments?
No, that was great. I was quite enjoyed that last 5-10 minute segment there. I was just sitting back and listening. Yeah, very, very informed. Yeah, liked it.
Good.
Right.
Well, yes, thank you very much, James. And, yeah, maybe we can catch up again in the not-too-distant future. But yeah, thank you very much for your time. And take care.
Great. Thank you very much, gents.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.